evening. Good Monday again. This is officially the last lecture of the showroom series. I'm happy to announce, as is my custom, we'll start from next week and work our way back. Next week, Yetzer Hashem, there will be another lecture. The guest speaker will be Rav David Stein Shlita. He's the Moed Asa of American Kehillah in Rehovos. He's been there for some 25 plus years. For those who are not familiar with the name, he is considered a mumcha par excellence in many spheres of kashrus, including being a shochet mumcha and traveling the world for pasta and olives and matzahs and all different kinds of ingredients. He still has a hand in kashrus and travels the world as well. And I can say for myself, this almost don't pick up a halacha seif on kashrus today where the Rav Stein's name is not quoted somewhere. So he will be our guest next week. We were a little fortunate through the Rav's efforts we were able to get him. Tonight's speaker is also a unique privilege, and I have to say, for those that are here and those that will be coming late, as a demon hug, it's truly, you know, a Bezalel Schutz today runs a company called Kosher Master, and that really sums it up. He is indeed a Kosher Master by every sense of the world. He has over 20 years under his belt, being an expert working for Badatz Rav Yehuda Leib Landau Shlita and Av Beis Din of Bnei Brak, and today, in his semi-retirement, he answers questions for people around the world, kashrus agencies around the world, and has a database both on a computer and, I think, under his hat. So without boring you with my remarks, I'd like to introduce Rav Schutz.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Yehiel. I want to thank, first of all, thank you very much for organizing this opportunity for me to speak. And Rabbi Malinowitz, for having me here in your shul. Again, this opportunity to speak to the people in our native language. Opportunity doesn't come up too often here in Israel. As Rabbi Yehiel explained, I've worked for over 20 years for Rabbi Landa in charge of the Ingredient Approval Department and Industrial Food Processing Department, in which during that time I spent collectively quite a few years traveling around different locations and a very wide range of ingredients of all different types. Tonight I want to keep on target more or less regarding the subject of flavors and the kashrus aspect of flavors, which I think I find it a fascinating subject and one that I've spent a lot of time learning and experiencing. I think, basically, the entire food industry has gone over, when we say recent years, really we're talking about even the last 100 years, and just like everything else that's going on with modern technology, everything is continually speeding up faster and faster. I remember reading in the Chafetz Chaim when said, you know, we've come to Achrit Yamin, and now HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to finish up all the cheshbonis before it's time to bring everything to a conclusion. And I think we can even see it in food technology. For a lot of people ask frequently regarding they ask even just in general about kashrus organizations. They say, you know, we have this proliferation of organizations. I think anybody who knows familiar with Kashrus magazine, a magazine that comes out in the States, and once a year they give a listing of all the kashrus organizations in the world that they're aware of, and he's now past the 1,000 mark of organizations around all different parts of the world. And people say, what happened 100 years ago? There were no organizations at all, and how did people manage? How did people eat kosher? But basically, people made most of their food at home, and the only thing that was really involved with Hashgacha and Rabbonim was Shechita and everything else. People made their own bread, they made their own jams, everything they cooked, and we didn't have all the ready prepared foods that people have today. Now it's really almost impossible it's really impossible to be personally familiar with what goes into different products, and certainly what goes on in the manufacturing plants where these things are made. And this brings us to the situation where we have to rely on the kashrus organizations, who do have people going in, people who have learned or familiar with the ingredients, the chemistry of the ingredients, the science of these, the technology, the food technology and the production, to understand what's going on, and they can make the evaluations, what is kosher and what is not kosher. And I think one of the most really complex and interesting aspects of this is in itself the subject of flavors. Everybody really knows the name flavors, and we talked about ingredients and labels. People usually go into the store. I don't know anybody. I find that my wife doesn't take me shopping with her anymore because she never gets to finish. We never finish or get out because I'm always stopping at all the shelves and picking up the packages and reading the labels and not helping. She'd rather just throw it in the cart and get on with it. But virtually every product on its labels will have some kind of flavors, artificial, natural. And it's not possible to understand what these flavors, what's the nature of these flavors. In order to understand it better, it would be good just to give a few words explanation. What is a flavor? And we find that in many languages, and even English, one of the words used for flavor is aroma. And aroma, of course, brings to mind the sense of smell. We know we smell aromas, and the reason why the word aroma is used in conjunction with flavor, because it really, the sense of smell plays a very important part, really a central part in being able to sense flavors and understanding the differences between the different flavors. Our first thought would be, well, we put food in our mouth and we chew it and we taste it, and we have what we call the taste buds on our tongue, and from this we know what we're eating. But the truth is, this is really only a very basic aspect of the flavor, the specific flavors of each individual different food product. As we say, we have sweet and sour, bitter, salty, astringent. These are very basic differentiations that we can make from the taste buds on our tongue. But in order to get really into the details of a flavor, we find that it's the olfactory system, the sense of smell, which can distinguish between thousands and thousands of different flavor notes, or aroma notes, as we'd call them. And basically what happens, we eat things, we chew them, or we drink them, and the chemicals that make up the flavor, we think of chemicals, everybody knows flavors are made up of flavor chemicals. The truth is, the actual flavors in the natural foods themselves are also made up of these chemicals, but as a natural source. And they're called volatile. They're like a gas that when they're chewed or swallowed, these gases are released, and we feel them either through our nose or through the passage. Anybody who's had a bad cold knows the connection between his sense of smell in his nose and his mouth. So the flavors actually go in internally, go up into the olfactory system, and the sense of smell is able to, as we see here, up to even 90% of the actual taste of different foods. So when we sense all these, the combination of the taste buds with the olfactory nerves in the nasal system, there where we can determine what it is that we're basically eating. I think people also are aware of the fact, if you have a cold and you can't smell things, you also can't taste them, for the same reason. Okay, this is this flavor wheel. I'm not sure. Okay, I guess you can see this. On the left side we have taste, on the right side odor. And it's divided into subcategories. This is a flavor wheel that was described by a different flavor company. It gives different categories of flavors that are relevant to either the mouth or the nose, in the sense of the taste buds in the tongue, or in the sense of smell. Okay, I think really, as we see here, the commercial flavors were actually beginning to be produced industrially in Europe in the 19th century. We're talking about over 100 years ago. And the first companies that did this were actually the fragrance manufacturers. They were going much further back than that. People were making perfumes. Perfumes go back centuries and centuries, and even we're talking about even thousands of years, basic natural substances were used for fragrances. But because of the professional knowledge of the fragrance companies, they were actually the first companies that began to manufacture also the flavors. Okay, I think I'm going to stay back on this one for a second. We have to understand when we're talking about these flavors, and we saw in the wheel different categories, but the categories are not the actual chemicals themselves. And when we're talking about chemicals, we're talking about thousands and thousands of chemicals. The International Regulatory Organization, which categorizes food chemicals as there's GRAS, generally recognized as safe, lists 4,000 ingredients. But if you go into a flavor house, and the big international flavor houses, you'll find that they can have 5, 10, 15, 20,000, because many of these chemicals come in different variations. Of course, we can be talking about dry substances, liquid substances, this is really one of the major source of the complexity. What they're putting together, and this makes it difficult for, say, the kosher consumer. Number one, there's so many ingredients there that it's not possible, even if somebody wanted to list all of these on the label of a product, because one flavor could be 10, 15, 100, or a couple hundred different chemicals. There's not even room for it. And in principle, the flavor companies are very secretive and do not divulge how they make specific flavors, because this is what gives them their competitive edge. Additionally, they're not interested in having people know, their customers don't want people knowing what they're using. I think one of the best examples, one of the most famous examples that people know, of course, is Coca-Cola, which they're making their product is, they keep everything so secret that they don't have it made by a flavor company. Many flavor companies make cola flavors and other beverage flavors and sell them to some of the other smaller companies. But Coca-Cola, from start to finish, makes their own flavor, and they're just another specific, dedicated flavor house that works internally to make their own products. And I was able to compare this in the experiences I had working together with Rabbi Landa as he developed, and I was there with him when he was developing giving the Hekshar to the Coca-Cola products. So we have the ingredients. The ingredients, of course, come from many different sources. They can be natural ingredients. Even these spices, we can have using spices directly. A lot of people are familiar with Bisley products or the savory snacks, and there'll be spices. There'll be actual dried ground onion or garlic or other spices in these. And additionally, there'll be flavors that can be made from extracts from various spices and combined in different combinations to get a very special taste that the manufacturer, the food manufacturer, is looking for in his product. This is a list of the, to understand the significance of the flavor industry. This is the 10 top international flavor manufacturers, and you can, again, the number one company which has 20% of the international market of flavors, Givaudan, is close to $4 billion, had an income, a gross income of close to $4 billion in 2009. And these markets are continually growing. Incidentally, number 10, Frutarom, is actually an Israeli company. And when I first met them, and when I started with Rabbi Lanza 25 years ago, the head office is in Haifa, in the Haifa Bay, and it was a small flavor company making mostly local flavors. And over these last 25 years, through internal growth and acquisitions, there's a lot of combining of these companies, and one company buys up another, and that's how these have all become multimillionaires. Everybody here is close to the minimum of, say, $500 million of flavors annually. Okay, another important point to understand is the fact that the flavors, although they're very small component in actual amount, they can be less than 1%, even less than 0.5% in a given product, and some of the chemicals are very, very strong, and very small amounts can provide a taste or flavor. Because they're actually made to give the flavor, then they're nice and tam, and it really can't consider them as being butthole or, you know, null and void. And this is an interesting thing, because a lot of times I hear people talking, again, the example of Coca-Cola, people who drink Coca-Cola all around the world, and they say, you know, listen, it's all very, what could be in there, and if there's anything there, it's a very minute amount, and how much could it be? But if there's things in there, and the flavor is what's making the final product, it's true. Coca-Cola, like any carbonated beverage, I don't have to. Obviously, the largest single ingredient in it is water. And without it, but the flavor that comes is from the flavor concentrate that gives the flavor is obviously it's critical to know whether the ingredients making up that flavor and giving it its basic nature, whether they're kosher or not. Okay, if we look and see we spoke a little bit about the ingredients, the flavor ingredients, and we see that in the flavor manufacturer, we see that it could divide the major areas of concern into three areas: ingredients, the manufacturing equipment, and the supervision, and to determine what kind of supervision needs to be done in this plant. Okay. This is just a picture in it. This is in a plant. I don't think they'll mind me telling you, this is a picture Jim Woodard sent me. I asked him for a picture of this, and they sent me this one out of, this is in one small area of there where they're manufacturing liquid flavors, and you can see chemicals, some of them in barrels, sitting on the side here, or even smaller things here, down to little tiny things where maybe they're only taking in a flavor, a total flavor that could consist of even a ton of flavor, with all of its ingredients, might have several ingredients that are there only in several grams of each one. They're so powerful are the ingredients that are used. Again, we said there were thousands, and this company may have thousands of barrels and packages with each one with different ingredients. And the products that they make, we're talking then, their final products could reach into the tens of thousands, because they're maybe custom designing them for each one. For example, we say vanilla flavor. It sounds very simple, but they can be. There's vanilla flavors that are liquid for liquid products. There can be vanilla flavors, dry powders for baking products, and various the company will give samples to the prospective customer, and they'll say, no, I want it a little bit more sweet, a little bit more dry, a little less. And slowly they'll develop this by changing the chemical makeup of this until it exactly meets the requirements and the desires of the end customer. When we look at this, in the ingredients, basically we can say that they can be divided into three categories. There's ingredients used in the world of flavor manufacture that are inherently non-kosher. Then there are other ingredients that are inherently kosher. Or the third group, which the actual kosher status of the ingredients are determined by numerous variables that we'll explain as we go along. Inherently non-kosher. There's a material called civet, which comes from the glands. It's a liquid. It's a secretion that comes out of the glands of this civet cat, which we can all see. It's not a kosher animal. And although its primary use for this material is perfumes, It is present in flavor compounds and in flavor formulations. Obviously not kosher ones, but this is one of the reasons why it's critical to know if we're eating something that has a kosher certified flavor in it or not. Another creature who wouldn't bother us too much to see him in the zoo, or maybe even not out in the forest, we certainly wouldn't want to find his secretions in the food we're eating. Ambergris, also coming from sperm whales, from the digestive system. I don't know that we want to.
When you ask that, we can, unless it's something you mamas don't understand, hold the question till the end.
Make it louder, okay. Okay. Or this is one that I think is even more commonly understood. Colors. We didn't mention too much about colors, but colors are a very integral part of flavor systems. They can be sold to food manufacturers independently, meaning that the food manufacturer may be buying colors to add to his food. Or, very often, the colors can be added directly into the flavor, and either because they want the flavor to have a certain color, or they may give it a strong enough color so that it'll actually impact the final product. Basically, cochineal, carmine, and if you go around the world, you will find this listed many times on food products, not kosher ones. Basically, they take the thousands upon thousands of these little beetles, and they grow on cactuses. One of the common locations for them is Mexico and similar areas, and they're ground to a pulp, and they exude this red color, which is later used. Kosher approved, but Food and Drug Administration approved food color. I don't know. I don't know. I'm gonna. First of all, I think M&M's have somebody's texture on them, so I'm gonna guess.
No, they
could listen. They could be in a lot of things. They could be in a lot of things. You, like I say, if you know one place, you could probably look in the States. You could walk around and look. Obviously, you want to look at labels of non-kosher certified products, but you will find this on labels of food products. Okay, then there's a product that we call inherently kosher, meaning that as is they should be kosher. Now even these I don't want to say, because even a kosher product could be processed in a non-kosher environment, or it could be more sophisticated downstream use of this product, which we'll give a few examples as we go on, but inherently kosher products could be either natural, such as sugar or coffee, or petrochemical products, such as chemicals that we know are always of petrochemical origin, such as some of the ones that we've listed here, propylene glycol, butyl formate, allyl sulfide, allyl captane. Now, the chemical ones here, you generally won't find on labels because they're in the flavors, unless occasionally something may be used as a carrier in a big amount, and for some reason they decided, like propylene glycol, but generally you won't see these on the labels. As I mentioned here, when flavors were very much oriented towards the petrochemical, what a lot of people call synthetic, it was definitely a much easier situation for kashrut organizations, because if you can look at all the ingredients and say, oh, they're all petrochemical, we're not talking about health, but from kashrut's point of view, if it's from petroleum, then there's not a problem of kashrut with it. But today, more and more, with the modern awareness of health issues, people are continually looking for more and more natural alternatives to the non-natural or synthetic ingredients.
Kashrut does not have any responsibility as far as health. Like, I was always curious, like MSG floats around here so much and all these...
Maybe we'll... What?
If you respond, repeat it about all
the... Okay. The question was, is kashrut, meaning I guess the kashrut organizations who give kosher certification to to products, are they responsible for the health aspects of the products or the specific ingredients that they certify? I'd say that's a very complex question, and it's a question that Rabbanim discuss with growing frequency. I would give just a general guideline this is my opinion, and I don't know whether, I'm not sure if there's anybody who's really come down to it and have a real, real talk on this, but I would say if a kashrut organization sees something that's mamish be'etzem inyan, it's not healthy. In a factory, and they see they're using spoiled products that can give people, you know, all kinds of, make people sick, I would assume that the kashrut organization would say something, how it should be handled. With the kashrut organization should approach the company and say, listen, we're not going to approve this if you continue to use this. Maybe the company doesn't know it's happening. Obviously, things happen where they're not intentional, and then obviously the company would obviously be happy that either the kashrut mashgiach or any other worker in the factory would help them, protect them from accidentally doing something like this. But if it's in the event that we're talking about companies which, for whatever reason this is, and their concept of what their obligations are to their consumer public are not what we would think they are, then if it's really out and out unhealthy, we'd assume somebody would say something. And I don't know, you know, I would assume that the plant representative, the mashgiach, would say something to the organization, and the organization would say something, because to have your name, a kashrut organization is in many ways is a partner with the manufacturer. It's a partner, maybe not economically, financially, but his name is on there just like anybody else. And obviously nobody wants to be involved in something that's such as this. Now, the specific question you asked, you asked about MSG, monosodium glutamate. And the fact is that monosodium glutamate has government approval in terms of, it's not a prohibited ingredient. There's many opinions, and when you start talking about health, I don't have to tell you that there's just a full rainbow of people's opinions. There's people who say to eat meat is completely unhealthy, and the only healthy way to live is to be a complete vegetarian. Other people say you can only eat this, you can only eat natural things. There's a full range of things. Now, if these things are within a framework that the health authorities of any place, of the country, have investigated these things, and their determination is that these are permitted, that they're healthy. We know, just like there's Naval B'Rishut HaTorah, you can have somebody who can be, you know, even to eat completely healthy things, and if somebody eats too much from that, then it's also not healthy. But if it has a seal of approval from an official health organization, I don't know if the kosher organization has the responsibility to go for that. Do they have to go out and advertise, listen, we're giving a hechsher on these snacks, but you should know they're not so healthy because they contain MSG. I don't know. You know, that seems to me to be out of the province of the kosher organization, but that's my personal opinion. Maybe other people think differently. At any rate, we're talking about things that are inherently kosher. I would say this: the kosher organizations have the first ones who came out with this was the OU. So people, everybody knows of the OU, the Orthodox Union, the American organization, which is actually the largest kosher certifying organization in the world, with the largest number of certified companies, the largest number of products, and they have in their organization a system of grouping ingredients according to level of requirements, and they call something, they have something called a group one, and what a category, an ingredient that's put in the category of group one means it's kosher and approved from any source. They don't even ask the company to tell them where it's coming from. They say, because that's always kosher. So I assume on the OU Group 1 list are things like sugar. And I say coffee, it would depend, of course, in what the system is. Here we see sugar from the sugar cane, or if it's in Europe and other locations, it could be from sugar beets. And then in the middle we have here, this is crude sugar, which has not yet been refined in storehouses, and the final sugar cubes of fully refined white sugar. Most kosher organizations don't find any significant problems with sugar for year-round use anyway. For Passover, everybody's interested to know, they use antifoams in the process. Do the antifoams have any non-Passover ingredients? Is there any other problems in the system? For example, maybe they're doing powdered sugar, confectionery sugar, and they may be adding anti-caking agents to that. Maybe there's some X there. One thing that was a year-round issue, one of the sugar manufacturers in Europe with kosher certification from one of the European certifying organizations a number of years ago had brown sugar, which is basically brown sugar, as everybody can understand, it's the same as white sugar, but the brown comes generally from molasses, which in the last stages in the refining is rinsed off of the sugar, and if you don't rinse it off, then you still have brown on there, some molasses on the white sugar. The sugar inside is the same as the regular white sugar, but it has the addition of some molasses. I will say that the most common way of making the brown sugar, though, is usually most companies take white sugar and then put molasses back on the sugar, because it's just easier for them to store that way, and when they need brown sugar, that's the best. And all brown sugar uses molasses from cane sugar. And even if the original sugar was made from beet sugar, from sugar beets, they don't use sugar beet molasses because it doesn't taste good. It's only fit for really animal feed. And so they purchase cane sugar molasses and then they add it on, and they have brown sugar also. So there was a company, a European company, and they were in their brown sugar because the sugar tends to stick because of the dampness, they were adding glycerin to the brown sugar, and it hadn't occurred to them that they really had to ask the certifying organization if this is okay. I will say that when this was discovered, if there was a problem with the original glycerin or not, that from then on they were using kosher certified glycerin. I'll give a few words about glycerin as we go on, as one of the ingredients of the third category. Coffee, again, when we talk about coffee, everybody can understand coffee beans as they come, they're a plant that grows. They don't grow in Israel, so there's no trumas and maisis. There's no shemitah on coffee. So as they are, generally people roasting coffee are roasting them. Definitely, if we're talking about the big companies, if we're talking about Nestle's or Elite here or other international companies, then they have big plants where all their roasting is coffee, and they're not roasting other things. And finally, if we're talking about instant coffee, the coffee is then after it's been roasted, it's ground, cooked in large tanks into big tanks of liquid coffee, just like you would make in your home, and then dried. If we have an opportunity, I'll speak a little bit about spray dryers, because the instant coffee is spray dried. And again, if we talk about the big coffee companies, they have their own spray dryers that are working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, spray drying coffee. But I personally was in there. If you're traveling around and you see little boutique labeled coffee companies, some name you never heard of, it may be that company has no plant of his own, and he's contracting it out to somebody else. And there's plenty of spray drying companies around the world that do contract spray drying, where they could be spray drying mamish treifas one minute, and then when they finish that, they could go over to spray drying coffee and making instant coffee on the same equipment. And we're talking about equipment that's hot with bleas and everything. And so even something as seemingly innocent as coffee has potential for having its kashrut issues. The final thing we said was we mentioned variable kosher status, and then we're talking about basically things where it could be what makes the variable status can be either because of the source, either the source of the ingredient itself, or the way it was processed, the equipment it was processed on. If we find here ethyl alcohol, this is what we call ethyl alcohol. Is ethanol the alcohol that is in alcoholic beverages. Many of the beverages are basically just. We're not going to speak about the alcohol beverages. We have things like whiskey, where they ferment the malted grain, and then they distill it to bring it up to a higher concentration of alcohol. Or you have people making things like vodka, which is not distilling the actual things. They could be buying pure ethanol, diluting it to the required percentage, adding maybe some kind of a flavor to it. So the ethyl alcohol, there's ethyl alcohol food grade, which is petrochemical, made really in the distillation process of petroleum. Many byproducts come off, many chemicals, and they can be purified. The ethanol that comes out of that can be purified to make it usable even for food grade. Or the ethanol could be, the alcohol could be made by fermentation of carbohydrates, any carbohydrates, so this will get the alcoholic beverages. Or it could be then manufactured and refined to the 99.6%, which is close to pure, and used for other purposes. Or there could be alcohol that's chametz, because it's made from any of the grains that were fermented. And there can even be alcohol. There's in Europe and Ireland, there's a factory manufacturing alcohol from whey. It's taking the liquid whey, for there's a very big dairy industry in Ireland, and this company purchases the whey, collects it, and the lactose, the sugar in the that came out of the milk is in there, and he collects that and he ferments that and makes alcohol. And this alcohol is food grade alcohol, but it's made from lactose of not even Chalav Yisrael. Okay, glycerin. We mentioned it before. Glycerin is a very common chemical used in flavors and many other products. It's basically a byproduct of the oleochemical industry. We find that we know that oils themselves are called triglycerides. When you go to the doctor and you get a full blood test and you want to see, one of the things they check is what's the level of triglycerides in your blood. And basically, what it is, how much oil do you have in your blood? And the triglyceride, so the oils that we talk about, the edible oils, are all triglycerides, because they're made of a molecule of glycerin, and attached to that, three molecules of fatty acids. Now, in the oleochemical industry, all these different chemicals, the different oils can be taken. It could be petroleum oil, or it could be very common in palm oil, coconut oil, and even fats and oils from animal origin. And these oils are split. They separate the fatty acids from the glycerin. Now we have glycerin, which can then be purified and refined and used for many, many different purposes, including flavors or in foods directly. And the fatty acids are then also used for different things. They can be used for food purposes, medicinal purposes, stearic acid, which comes out, which is a big, large amounts of stearic acid come out of palm oil, and it's used to make the rubber in tires, synthetic tie in tires. It's used also very commonly used in dough improvers to help it, whatever the different things to do. They do dough improvers, which is helping keep them fresh, more airy, different things. And so we see it's very critical to know the glycerin and the fatty acids, are they coming from a kosher oil? And are they being split in a factory that's only doing kosher oil? Even if they're from palm oil, but if they're being split in a splitting column where they also do other fats and oils, then it's also, it compromises the kosher status of these products. Essential oils, we mentioned earlier that spices are very often used as is. They can be just dried and ground and added to products. Everybody has at home used garlic granules or onion flakes, and these are actually the actual products that have been dried and then cut or reduced in size, even down to powder. Or we can have where the different spices or other plants, virtually every plant, different kinds of flowers and other plants and the different parts of them. It can be the leaves, stems, petals of the flowers, the roots. It can be extracted, have the basic elements of them extracted. They can be, very often they're steam extracted. And we talk about steam, they're extracted in the fields by the farmers where they just boil water underneath and the steam goes up and then they collect the steam, and the steam contains the volatile chemicals. We mentioned volatile chemicals that give the flavor or the fragrance. So, but basically then they're finally also refined. So we need to know, number one, was it just steam distilled from the plants, or maybe they did a solvent extraction, maybe they took ethanol, and the ethanol, was that ethanol kosher or not kosher that they used to extract it? And finally, where was it refined? Was it refined in a kosher place or not in a kosher place? All of these things need to be investigated in order to determine whether the ingredients are kosher or not. Okay, this is dry yeast. It's not completely dry. We see it's dry yeast. It's already been already starting to dissolve. Basically, I think people are familiar with, you can get dry yeast. You can get dry yeast in all the grocery stores. We don't have a factory in Israel manufacturing this. So all the different companies, Paka, who has dry yeast. I'm not talking about the cubes of yeast or whatever, but we're talking about, which are cubes of fresh yeast or extruded pellets of fresh yeast. But we're talking about actual dry yeast. And everybody is making them in companies. A lot of it's coming from Turkey, in plants in Turkey. So we have several issues. First of all, basically what's done is you have to manufacture yeast. We're talking about, you have to manufacture fresh yeast, which is really dependent. It's a fermentation process. We take basic yeast, feed it, grow it on carbohydrates, and then purify this. And it's given many, many nutrients, and the nutrients can be either kosher or not kosher, determining whether the final product is kosher. And then when we go to dry the yeast, there's added generally in order to help keep it a longer shelf life and to make it more usable. It's, and an emulsifier is added. The emulsifier, we really didn't mention about emulsifiers, but they can be kosher or not kosher. They're oily, fatty products, and they can come from vegetable or animal origin. So it's also critical to know in a dried yeast product to follow all these stages to see whether they're kosher or not.
The first stage matters. The yeast really matters, or is it a microorganism eating?
Okay, I know there was the number of years ago the post-scheme of the OU, Rabbi Belsky and the other rabbis there had a big dune on what they called this, like they called it the halachic cow. There was the term they used. You know, if you know, do we ask, we drink milk from a cow or we eat the meat from a cow? Did we ask him what he ate? Yeah, he ate it and he digested it and that's it. But it. Basically, although even the OU, where they tended to at least use this as at least as another factor in determining whether a final product was kosher, even they're still interested in having all of the ingredients be kosher ingredients. We're talking about basically minerals, but there's minerals, there's vitamins, minerals, carbohydrates, proteins. It's really a full 10-course meal they give this, you know, the yeast to grow on. And all the for sure, all the Mahadran Heksherim will investigate into the last detail what are all these ingredients that are being used. And incidentally, just that yeast can also, different kinds of yeast or yeast extract type products, which are also used as flavors. They can give a lot of these things in, get... There's meat flavors, beef flavors, chicken flavors, turkey flavors that are done by also using different types of yeast extracts, which they've been able to modify to give them these different types of flavors. Okay, before we get there, just the last thing I want to say about ingredients is the, of course, then we have the whole situation with another very common ingredient, as is, used in products as it is, and also used in flavors, are fruit and vegetable extracts, both liquid concentrates and powders. Now, aside from the fact that we know fruits and vegetables, there's many things that are coming from Israel, one of the common things is orange juice concentrates, or orange oil concentrates. Very common flavor ingredient is the oil. When we say orange oil is an oil extracted from the peels of the orange. These oils, orange oils, are all the different types of citrus fruit oils, can be used straight as they are, or they can be in sophisticated processes concentrated where they're much, much, much stronger, and the flavor houses can use them in much smaller components to give the same effect. I don't want to tell you how many different places around the world that I visited and I saw fruit juice or fruit oil components coming from Israel, from the Israeli citrus fruit flavor. And if we're talking about companies that maybe they're still making these products, obviously, in many cases, whether it's Orlo or not is only depending on the psak of, say, the local rabbinate. They may be doing Shemitah after Mechira, and saying for sure, well, it's okay, it goes, it's not even going to Yidden, you know, it's going to some Goy in China, so, you know, who cares? But it may be that the Goy in China is using it to make a flavor to send back to Israel, so you never know how far around the world the different things can go. As after ingredients, we mentioned the situation of equipment, and really, ideally, the best thing to do would be to have dedicated kosher manufacturing lines that would always make kosher. But because, as important as kosher is in the international food industry, it's still not everything, and many companies find it's number one, to always work kosher is too expensive because maybe many of the ingredients, they have to pay a premium to have a kosher version of different product, of different ingredients, and to work... So they don't want to work all the time kosher, and to have a separate line for only kosher is also prohibitive. So we're talking about production, very sophisticated manufacturing equipment that we're talking about in the millions and millions of dollars. And to have two sets, at home you can have milchik and fleishik, but in these factories to have kosher or non-kosher, it's not realistic. So basically what we're talking about is where people have to, the certifying organizations have to understand the manufacturing process, understand how everything works, how the machines work inside, what do we have to do to kosher the equipment if it's done something not kosher before we want to use it. And again, we're reliant on the expertise of the kosher professionals. One of the very central aspects, especially when we're talking about dry flavors, where flavors that are added to powders, is a spray drying process. And you can see here, this is actually a person here standing here, so you can understand this spray dryer could be as much as like 10 stories high if we're talking about the whole process. This is the very bottom where the product comes out, the dried product comes out. I don't know how much people are familiar with the spray drying process, but basically, we're talking about trying to use equipment where the process works, that many products, when we talk about milk powder, instant coffee, powdered eggs, they're all sprayed in a similar process, or flavored. And basically, a product is liquid form, it's preheated, sent to this equipment. We can see another example of it, and comes out, is sprayed into a hot, into that whole big compartment we saw has heated air. The product is sprayed through these nozzles, an atomizer nozzle, and there's a large surface area allowing the water to very quickly evaporate. What remains is the dried product. This can be then collected, and we now have a powder, an instant product. For example, this is how the coffee is done, and you can then take what was coffee, turn it into dried coffee. All you have to do is add back the water, and you have a cup of coffee. Or as there's a company in Meron, we now call Cham, here in Israel, makes also spray dried eggs. And I remember somebody when I was there one day, somebody called them. He says, these eggs are like real eggs. I mean, what can I do it? What can I do with it? And so the manager said, "He said she'd do everything with it except make a sunny side up." And it's basically that's it. It's just an egg. We're just missing the water. Okay, there's many issues here. Maybe it's good for another setting to save for another time, because there's issues of steam and where, how is the steam made, and what else is the steam used for? Does it, the steam heating kosher and non-kosher also? Suffice it to say that it's very complex also to understand how to do this. Okay, at the end, after coming out of the spray dryer, it usually goes into a piece of equipment called a fluid bed, where it cools down and gets its final drying. This is what the inside of the fluid bed looks like. These are portable steam generators that can be used to do boiling water to help in kosher equipment. And a bit of the team of people in one of the kosher conferences, of people who are working all the time to learn more and more all the time about how the different things work and what they need to do kosher. And I think basically, if we talk about what are the basic factors in supervision, we're talking about controlling the factory's ingredient, the ingredient reception in the factory before production, to know what's going on there, what comes into the factory. Is it all kosher? Not all kosher. Do we keep it separate? Are we on top of what's there? Then making sure that in the kosher productions, only kosher ingredients are used. Labeling the products correctly. There's also kosher warnings, kosher alerts coming out all the time. This product was mislabeled. It was labeled par, but it's really dairy. It's labeled Chalav Yisrael. It's really Chalav Stam, Akum, whatever, whichever term you prefer. So to make sure that it has really the correct final label. And what you have to say, most critical of all, is Siyata Dishmaya, without that, nothing else really help us. I don't know if we have time for a short story or a personal story. One of my own stories of Siyata Dishmaya. A number of years ago, we were asked to approve for a company making margarine. They wanted to buy palm oil from the oil plantations in a country called Papua New Guinea. It's like after Indonesia and further to the east of Indonesia and Australia, out there in the Pacific Ocean. And Rabbi Landa says, okay, Bezalel, you'll go out there and check and see if it's okay. Does anything else go on there? Can we use the oil from there? We can't use the oil from there. It was, first of all, just even my travel agent couldn't get any information on flights that go there. It wasn't in the international system, so we had to get somebody in Singapore, which is much closer, and they know what's going on in Papua New Guinea. And they said, here, this, call up and order this flight, order that flight. We did that. Okay, then we're trying to find out, what do we need to know? Somebody said, I was supposed to go on a Sunday, and on Thursday, late Thursday night, somebody said, listen, you know, you need a visa to go there. I'm an American, you need a visa to go there. Friday morning, what do I do? Friday, it was already here in Israel, Friday, where Friday everything is basically, the government offices are closed, but the foreign office has a situation. The guy sitting there, what do? They even have somebody, obviously, they have somebody on Shabbos in case something happens in the world. Somebody's there to see what's going on. The situation room, emergency room, it was Friday morning, I called up. And I said, you know, I need to go to Papua New Guinea, because I call somebody, how about they have an embassy here? She says, listen, they don't have an embassy here, but the embassy of Papua New Guinea in the UK, they deal with things also for us, so you can call them up. Now, the UK, it's 2 hours behind, so they said they open up at 9 o'clock UK time. It's already 11 o'clock here in Israel. I waited and waited. They gave me the phone number. I called up 11 o'clock in the morning. I call up and I speak to some woman there. I said, I want to go to Papua New Guinea on Sunday. I hear I need a visa. What can I do? She said, well, if you're calling from Israel, why don't you call up our consulate in Jerusalem? I said, because you don't have a consulate in Jerusalem. And she said, sure we do. I said, okay, the Israeli Foreign Office doesn't know that you have one. But she gave me the number. And I called up the guy. And I said, I need a visa. He says, no problem. Come in and I'll stamp your passport and I'll stamp it. Very nice guy. And he was actually had something from Australia, but he was taking care of Papua New Guinea. He says, come in. I have to go Sunday. He says, come in now. I says, well, you're in Jerusalem and I'm in Kfar Gidon, which is up by Afula, and it's 11:30 already. So what time do you close? He says, 12:30. He said, it was before Klishesh. He said, no way I'm going to get there. I said, so what do I do? He says, listen, you can try when you get there. You can try to get a visa at the airport when you land in Port Moresby. I said, why? What do you try? I mean, how about, can I get one? And he says, well, he says, it depends on if when you get there, if there's somebody there at the counter. Because he says, if not, sometimes it takes a day or two before somebody comes to the counter. They get it. Okay, what can we do? And then I started saying, you know, I was already aware. I asked him about food. I said, what about food? He said, nah, you can't take any food into Papua New Guinea. You know, it's definitely a super no-no. It can't, nothing you do. I said, but, you know, I only eat kosher food. And I have to take with me when I'm going. And from there, I was going to China, and I'm going to be gone for a couple of weeks, so I'm going to do no food with me. He says, I don't know, you can't take it in. He says, you know, they arrest people if they come and bring in food that you're not allowed to bring in. So I didn't know what to do, and I asked Rabbi Leonard, I said, maybe I should, you know, when I get there, maybe I can bribe him, you know, like, I can pay him something and let me bring the food in. He said, then he just laughed. He said, look, maybe other people do it. He says, you can forget about it. You'd never be able to do that. You couldn't keep a straight face, you know, do it. So I said, okay, what am I going to do? You have to try. Sunday morning comes. I took my passport with no visa to Papua New Guinea. I took my bag with my food in it, and I got on the plane. I flew on Sunday from Tel Aviv. I went through London. I got to London Sunday afternoon. Sunday evening was a flight to Manila in the Philippines. I landed in the Philippines Monday morning, waited there until Monday evening. Monday evening, a flight from Manila on Papua New Guinea Airlines from Manila to Port Moresby, the capital of Papua New Guinea, and I still had one more internal flight because there's no road there. It's a bunch of islands, and you have to like island hop on little propeller planes to go back and forth. So anyway, I'm on the plane. I get on the plane, and I'm sitting there, and before we take off, the captain and the pilot comes on and says, "We'd like to welcome the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea and his familia. We're here with him. They're just on a trip back from Japan." And everybody says, "Hi." I'm looking around, and I'm trying to see who's this guy. Don't know who he is. And I asked the guy sitting next to me, I said, who's the Prime Minister? And his name was Bill Skates. "Who's the Prime Minister?" And he looked at me and said, "You don't know the Prime Minister? You don't know the Prime Minister?" And he was very insulted, and he wouldn't talk to me anymore. So I'm sitting, I took one of the local newspapers, who was sitting on the seat, and I'm reading. I find at least three articles in the thing that mention Bill Skates, the Prime Minister. Not one of them has a picture. So I'm looking for a picture, I'm going to find this guy. Okay, what can we do? The plane takes off. It's a six-hour flight. The plane takes off, and all the people are walking around and saying hi. It's a lot of Papua New Guinea people. Bit by bit, I homed in on the guy. I could see that guy's the head cheese. You can see everybody's very deferential to him. And he was walking around the aisles, and he walked by me, and he looked at me. I'm sitting there, you know, my jacket and my hat, and which was not the regular dress for Papua New Guinea. And he just looked at me, and I looked at him. And I said, "Mr. Skates." And he said, "That's me." And I told him at the end, there's like 6 million people in Papua New Guinea. He said, "That population is not that much smaller than Israel." And he asked me who I was, what I was doing. And I told him that I was coming from Israel to see if the palm oil was kosher, because companies want to buy it, and if we say it's kosher, then they can use it. "Really?" He says, "Listen, when you come, we'll send you to lots of factories. Look at them all. They should buy from every factory you've got, you know, whatever." And he says, "Anything I can do to help you?" And I said, "Well, I'll tell you. You know, I'm doing this kosher." I give him a couple words what kosher is. "And I only eat special kosher food. And I understand that there's a difficulty with bringing food here." He says, and I told him I didn't have a visa. I said, "I don't have a visa." "No problem." Calls his administrative assistant. He says, "Jojo, come over here." And the guy comes over and he says, "When we land, you take care of the rabbi here. Go off the plane." Everybody gets off. They're walking. The Prime Minister and Jojo and their whole team walk through. All of a sudden, this door opens and they walk through it. And the guard comes and says, "Are you part of the Prime Minister's party?" And I don't know how to tell. So I said, "Well, not really." And he says, "Well, you can't go in." Okay, I said, "Well, there goes my assistants. I don't know what to do." And I walked in the regular way, and I'm there, and there's like teams of people there all shouting and the thing. And I see there's a place where they stamp visas, but there's a line 10 miles long, and there is somebody there. A few minutes go by, and I hear somebody shouting to me, "Rabbi, Rabbi." And I look, and there's Jojo on the other side. He's already inside, and he says, "Throw me your passport." I throw my passport over there. 5 minutes later, passport comes back. I look, there's a visa in the passport. Okay. He's waiting there on the other side. I go through. And he says, "Where's your bags?" They're on the carousel. They're on the carousel, and he says, "Okay, let's get them. We'll go." There's signs all over. "Last chance, throw any food that you have in your bags. 10 years in prison," all kinds of stuff, you know, like... And I'm like a little bit uptight, man. I got Jojo in line. Everybody's going as they go through, just like they go through customs. They're going through, and the guys there, every bag, they're opening them up. They're going through everything and all that. I'm just standing there. We get up to the front of the line, and they see this guy, Jojo, and he tells the guy, says, "Check his bag." The guy opens the bag, doesn't look down, closes, and says, "Next." And I was out. I was out with the food. I still had my last flight to go. It was from Port Moresby to another island in a little town called Kimby. And Kimby, that's where the factory was I had to go to. And the flight was at 1 o'clock. And they said, you have to be there an hour early, 12 o'clock. I came at 9:30. So I'm not taking any chances. And I'm waiting. The line forms up to check in. to check in for this. And I'm only going to be there for one day at this place, and I have to come back and go to another place. 9:30, I'm there. 10 o'clock, we're in line. There's a line, and the line, it's not moving at all. 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, everybody's standing. There's a guy, I couldn't understand it. There's somebody behind the counter, and everybody's standing in line, just standing there, and nobody's getting checked in. Just nobody checks in. And I called, and I said, listen, you know, the flight's in at 1 o'clock. I need to get on this flight. And he kept saying, yeah, it'll be okay. And I said, can you call a supervisor? Wait a few minutes, call him. I will call him, and I can see that, you know, everything's just going to be postponed. So I said, hey, what can we do? The flight already took off. You know, you need to get on the flight. And I came all this way just for this. I'm sitting there, and a little old man with a cane is standing behind me, and he says, in my ear, he gets close to me and he says, don't listen to him. Go straight to the gate. It seemed very strange, so I didn't, you know, the time's going by. And another time, this little guy comes up and says to me, go straight to the gate. Don't listen to anybody. I mean, I was getting very nervous that I'm not going to get there. So I decide I'm going to do it. I pick up my bag, and I walk, and I have the x-ray machine there, and everybody's stopping at it. I'm walking with my bag, and I walk through, and nobody stops me. It's like they couldn't see me, and I just walked, and I come to the gate, people are getting up on the plane. I don't have a boarding card, because I didn't check in. I don't have a boarding card, and I go up to the guy letting people up to the gate, and he looks at me, and I show him my ticket. I have the ticket, and it says that I bought a ticket to fly on this flight, but it's not a boarding card. And he looks at the ticket, he takes a pencil, and he writes, 2C. He says, that's your seat, go up. I go up on the plane, that's the last seat. No other seats, sit down in the seat. Got to Kimby, saw the factory, took a nap the first time after 3 days on the way, and then I came back. Actually, I don't know who this old guy with the cane was, but what I can say is definitely the whole trip I could see just see the Bishmaya the whole way, and without that there was no way that it would work. And the same thing is even in the plants, even everything seems it's al pi derech hateva, really, just like we say about everything else. The hateva that's also a nes, and you really need to see the Bishmaya for everything. I hope that I was there was some useful information. I'm very happy if anybody still has, you know, has the time and would like to ask questions, I'll be happy to answer any questions. Was the factory kosher? The factory was very, very kosher. They were only doing extracting and refining palm oil, nothing else, and it was perfectly good to use. And it was the only place I've ever been in all my travels where the factory didn't say, ah, yeah, you know, so-and-so, Rabbi so-and-so has already been here. Nobody had ever been to this factory. Huh?
Probably no one's
been there since.
But you were saying that when it's flavor, there's nothing physical, no matter how much.
Right.
And then you talk about this insect that makes
red
dye.
Yeah.
Which is a color, it's not a flavor.
Okay. So would that be bitter? Okay, I know it's not no ten. Tom, the question was, if we're talking about flavors, that they're not, we don't look at bittul with them because they give flavor, they're no ten tam. What about colors that are from bugs? The truth is that there's a lot of things going on. I won't say necessarily about the cochineal. I don't know I'm not aware whether anybody's actually approved that. You have, for example, there's shellac. Shellac is also made from insects, and this is not a color, but it's a shining ingredient, and it's very often used around the world. It's used also in donut. I'm not sure you call it in English, you know, that you put on fruits. A lot of times fruits, apples get them to polish the apples, but you can also find it on oranges and many other different types of fruits. And it's usually a mixture of different things to give it the right consistency, make it liquid enough to coat it. And shellac is very often one of the ingredients of these. Now, a lot of hechsherim do approve the use of this on the basis that it's not no ten tam, and many other sifim, but again, the Mahadran Hechsherim wouldn't use this, even though it's not no ten tam. Yes?
Do
What about cheese? I know there's a whole long list.
I can't hear you.
There's a whole long list of cheese approved.
E-numbers. Okay, E-numbers. First of all, E-numbers, we're talking about the European Union and identification numbers that they've given to many food additives. It's not necessarily chemicals. And E-numbers are not necessarily kosher. They could be kosher or not kosher. Cochineal has an E-number also, but it's not kosher. And other things could be emulsifiers or things that could be maybe kosher or not kosher, not because of the E that they are. The E, whatever E number is, that identifies what specific product that is.
Worldwide, you can't rely on whether Coke uses the same formula everywhere or not.
Okay, the question is, can you, for in a product like Coca-Cola, can you rely on it that they're using the same formula as they use here in Israel? Here in Israel, we know that Rav Landa gives the extra to Coca-Cola. In America, the OU gives the extra to Coca-Cola. So what about in other parts of the world? Can we drink Coca-Cola on the basis of that Coca-Cola has one formula that they're using all around the world? And the answer to that is that when we say the same formula is used, we're talking about this. They're using the same ingredients. But if you remember, one of the things we mentioned about ingredients is that there are ingredients that their kosher status varies according to either the source of the ingredient or the plant or the manufacturing equipment that it was made on. So even in Coca-Cola, you could have, even if you have the exact same ingredients in terms of it's the same taste, it doesn't mean that all those ingredients are kosher approved. Even something not related to Coke. If you have beef, I mean, if you can have beef that was from a cow that was shechted and that's kosher, you can have beef from a treif cow, and in the taste, you can't really tell the difference. And Coca-Cola, just because it tastes the same, it doesn't mean that the sources of the ingredients are the same.
So therefore you can't buy Coke worldwide.
If you're mocked on drinking things that you're sure you know they're kosher, well, you can't be sure that you know that Coke somewhere else is kosher. Another thing you have to understand when we say the same formula, we know that the plant, the bottling plant in Bnei Brak that makes Coca-Cola in Israel, they add in Bnei Brak they add water, sugar, and carbonation, the carbon dioxide. Everything else is in the flavor concentrate. I mean, the flavor is there, the colors are everything that they get from the International Corporation. The International Corporation manufactures for all the bottlers in the world. But the fact is that the International Corporation has numerous sites where they manufacture this concentrate, and it's not all manufactured where Rabbi Landa or where the OU supervise their production. So there's factories that I don't even know where they are making the same concentrate, and we don't know what else goes on there, what else do they make in the equipment.
To add to that, I spoke to some of the Rabbanim actually involved with the Coke in America. They basically said it's a misnomer, there's no factual basis for it. Coke, like anything else, people in the market are using products with Hexa, should only use it in countries with Hexa. And wherever this became known that Coke is kosher everywhere, they said no conscious organization in the world would accept that.
Right.
This is some of the reasons about saying it. Anyway, I think today, at least to my mind, contributed significantly to the process over the last week to show of him, to show the complexity of the kosher industry, and as a picture of the Rabbinical Council of Europe showed, a very small amount of the people that fly the world and go to New Guinea and even further. The mice, that's the truth, to bring kosher components to kosher. And I think, I hope at least, like I said last week, and I'll keep saying this, people should realize everything needs a hashra, basically. That's what we learned today, because there's nothing pure. Everything is a compound made up of subcompounds and chemicals, and so we need the Rabbanim and the Kashrut agencies to protect us, and each one decides what works for them.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to thank Shutz for coming. I'm slapping from the Afula area, doctor, not just coming from the neighborhood. And if anyone wants contact information or about the company itself, contact me. Vice versa, anything we'd be happy to give you. I don't know if you have cards with you.
I have no cards.
If you need cards, give them out. Get a space in the store. Once again, next week, Rabbi Linowitz asked me to add. I didn't say it. I didn't realize Rabbi Stein will actually walk us through, so to speak, shechita of chicken, shechita of behemoth, to give people an idea of actually what's involved and the differences in different kashriyot and what Mahajan does, what Mahajan doesn't do, what to worry about after the kosher meat hits the different areas and stages. So the show of him ends, but the kashrut lesson continues.
Thank you very much.
I remember what you said in that presentation when we the books got passed out. Dr. Pepper, last of Dr. Pepper, and you really pushed on Dr. Pepper.
I'll pass it along to the rabbi. I have to the I agree with you. That's why I kept on keeping the mic. But, the background noise is exceptionally loud. It's very difficult. It's a problem to bring someone this far and have such poor conditions. But on the video, don't ask me. I have nothing to do with it.
Another question.
Yeah. I have no family there.
Can you
please
send her the mic?
So next week, please, if there is a PowerPoint, I don't know. If it's no good, tell me.
Okay. Okay.
I've had him out in the kitchen sitting down and trying to find what I've seen in the paper. No good, tell me.
No, it's just when he stands
it. Like, that's how the people know, because I'll just leave that. Next week is Robert Spire, the following week, this will be the last lecture, will be Robert Mordechai Kubler.
Yeah.
Who will do quite a conclusion.
Right.
Is this particular one that got you have a headshot on it?
No, so that's it. So my limit now is America. I got led to Catholic organization in Ukraine, but the Catholic organization basically told me it's not kosher because it had E120, which is from insects, which is what he was talking about. But then it started making me think about like the American Catholic culture.
Well, that's why I always tell people, even though it looks like American, as you said, and in fact it could be South America, Europe, it could be anywhere, not lots of North America, depends what the setup is like. If it's something more than all you, this is not okay. If it doesn't,